Hello and welcome again to another edition of Lost in Science. This is half an hour on the radio thingamajiggy where we talk about sciencey things. Who are we? I am Stu, and with me on the show this week I have Chris.
Aloha. How are you, Stu?
I'm pretty good. And what sciencey things have you brought for us to enjoy this week?
Sciencey things. Now, there's a concept. Yeah, I can't help myself retreading old stories, I suppose. But this is not one of mine that I'm retreading, Stu. You'd be glad to know. It's something that you touched on, I think, in our last show of 2023. In the year 2023, I don't know if you remember, it was a long time ago, we talked a lot about AI.
Yeah.
Yeah, and its various impacts on the world. And you brought up the idea of its environmental impact. And
yeah, I did go into that a little bit, but I was looking at all sorts of things, energy use and how much money it costs to keep things running and lots of different things. There was a whole lot of stuff piling in.
Well, I thought there's been some, I guess, more written about that recently. So I thought I would dig into it a bit more about some estimates or what people are talking about in terms of the energy consumption of AI and what the implications may be. Yeah, I found it like it is a really interesting aspect. Something I think is a bit overlooked. We think about these technologies as existing in cyberspace. Nothing seems real, but they are related to the real world. And we do have to keep in mind the real world limitations and impacts of these things.
There's a cost to cheating on your homework,
apparently. That's right. So yeah, that's me. Yeah, we're going to look a bit more into the energy, and I might even bring up a bit of the old Bitcoin and crypto as well, just for the fans of that out there, because it's an interesting comparison.
Well, funnily enough, I'm going to be talking about energy as well, but I'm actually going to be talking about how energy moves between plants and fungi in forest systems. I've seen a lot of stuff written about this, and you know, I have actually studied this as well. I've done research into mycorrhizas, which are the fungus plant relationships in soil around the world in different places. There's been a lot of stuff about the forest internet, the wood wide web, I've seen it referred to as, which is supposedly connecting all the plants and all the fungi and all the forest, and it's all cooperative, and it's a whole network of communication. And I'm going to look a little bit into that because, as I said, I have researched this a bit myself, but there's also, I guess, a popularization of some of the ideas which don't actually fit with what the science has shown at this point. So it's just something that's sort of come up. People have been reviewing the science on this stuff and publishing things around the place. So I thought I'd look into that and, I guess, have a dig into mycorrhizal fungi.
I like it when we explore the real science behind things that are being sensationalized in the public consciousness.
It's a nice idea that's being popularized, but it's just not there. It's not been shown that's what's happening. So I'll explain that a bit more later in the show, and we'll hopefully increase everyone's energy levels with our science this week. On with the show.
Okay, yes, you are listening to Lost in Science, and yeah, I guess we're talking about the energy and what you discussed, Stu, the economics, I suppose, of technologies like artificial intelligence, AI. It is often said with these kind of things that if you're not paying for something, then you are the product. And I think we are all aware of how much money is involved in these large tech platforms. And I think we all feel a bit like we're being exploited or ripped off in some way. There are certainly people who are making a lot of money out of these things. But I don't think we should delude ourselves that these things could or should be free with no cost at all, because they do cost a lot of money. They cost a lot of energy to generate these technologies.
And it's not surprising if you think about what they're actually doing. There's a lot of processing power going into these things, and the you know, the image and text generating platforms that are around are getting built into everything. I was reading a news article today. Well, I thought I was reading a news article today and got halfway through it. It was only published in the last week, and halfway through it said, my database has been updated in January 2023. As of this time, these are the facts about this news article that it was writing about current events. So it was right. Kind of really weird that they just got this bot to write a news article. Here's what happened, or fed it the AP wire or something. It's just everywhere, and it's not really being shown that it's being there. But, you know, this is, someone's paying for it, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, they are getting more and more prevalent, and you probably don't even notice half the time that what you've got is being written by an AI. Now, the kind of stuff we're talking about, I suppose, we're thinking about these large language models they're known as, which is the things like your ChatGPT and the various other products out there. I think ChatGPT is the best known one. GPT is standing for something, pre-trained transformer, generalized pre-trained transformer or something like that. But it is, yeah, run by the company OpenAI, which is associated with Microsoft. Microsoft has been, I guess, testing an integration of that with its Bing search engine. Meanwhile, Google's parent company, Alphabet, has their own chatbot called Bard, which is also being tested with search. It's probably not as well known, perhaps, or as high profile, I guess, to the public. I think I haven't seen as much kind of awareness of it as, say, the Bing product, which, you know, being related to OpenAI, I think has been a bit more noticeable. But yeah, all this stuff is going on, and it is kind of, yeah, looking at a big business. And as you brought up, I think one of the main things you focused on, Stu, in your story last year, at the end of last year, was this training, the fact that I had to get trained on so much data and the amount of processing involved in that. But there's, I guess after the training phase comes what they call the inference phase, which is basically the application of the AI into, say, generating search results and that sort of thing, or the queries you might put into ChatGPT, those sort of things. And that is obviously going to be a significant part of its energy consumption as well.
Yeah.
Now, the estimates for it, well, there's no, look, okay, so I'm going to say, my main reference for this story is a paper that was published in the journal Joul last year by Alex de Vries, who is a PhD candidate from Amsterdam and founded a research company called DigiEconomist, which explores the economic consequences of digital trends. And this has been commented on a lot, this article, because it does kind of try to give an estimate of the energy costs of artificial intelligence. And it's, you know, some people dispute it a bit, but, you know, the actual article itself gives kind of a range of estimates. So, yeah, when we're talking about the inference stage, which is the actual kind of the query generating stage of AI, it's how much it is of the total cost varies depending on things like how often you have to retrain the model and what kind of queries it's generating. But it's often estimated to be somewhere around about 80% of the energy cost is in the inference or the use phase rather than the training phase of it, which is a huge amount.
Yeah.
And when you've got a company like Google, which is the biggest search engine in the world, and it is looking at integrating AI into its search engine, then it's worth asking what is going to be the impact on that.
So Google being the biggest search engine in the world, if they're integrating the AI into the search, does that mean every Google query is going to be using the AI that's built into it?
Well, I guess that is kind of your worst case scenario or your most extreme scenario. But it's unlikely perhaps to be the case, as we shall see. So the chairman of Alphabet, which again is Google's parent company, estimated that a search or with a AI on Google would cost about 10 times more than a standard search from via Google. So going by that estimate, It'd be a huge imposition on the, say, the energy costs. And it's been estimated that based on their current energy consumption and AI use, that if they integrate it fully with their search, they would use about 29.3 terawatt hours per year in AI, which is about the energy use of a country like Ireland. Whoa. So it's a fair amount of electricity, but this is, I'm not going to give too many numbers in this because these numbers are hard to understand what the significance of them. But yeah, that is obviously a fairly big number. It's probably not going to be realistic because you've got things like the technology that these systems run on. They use, you know, your graphic processor unit, your GPUs, and there's a limited supply of those in the world, and they cost a lot of money themselves. So I've seen a couple of different estimates of how much would be required for Google to fully integrate AI into all its searches. It would require roughly about 500,000 new servers based on these GPUs, and would cost in the hundreds of billions of dollars to set up. So it's unlikely to happen overnight just simply by the cost of it. It is a hugely expensive undertaking. We're going to put aside for the fact that, like I said, there are some bottlenecks, and put aside the main manufacturer of the chips in these things is in Taiwan, and Taiwan is in a precarious geopolitical situation as it is. So any of this could change depending on how the world shapes out in the next few years. But yeah, just looking at that alone, just the idea of Google completely having AI take over its search, it seems unlikely. You know, and a lot of people, though, also point to with these things that as you get increased usage of these technologies, you also get increased efficiencies. And there's kind of a hope that that itself will improve things. There's some positive and negative ways of looking at it, though. I think cryptocurrencies is a good kind of example of where there are some efficiencies that have improved its energy consumption. In particular, the case of Ethereum, the cryptocurrency, which switched its algorithm from, I guess, what people might have heard of Bitcoin mining, which is essentially you do a whole lot of calculations to generate new Bitcoins. Ethereum changed their model to one which is basically involved on, it's called, I think, something like proof of stack. So instead of having to do this as many calculations, you kind of had to prove your credentials, essentially. And it hugely cut the energy use of Ethereum and has left actually a lot of kind of data centers vacant or idle in the world, and perhaps freed up some chips for future AI. I think a few of them actually are repurposing into AI now. But you know, if Bitcoin were to adopt that, then it would be it would be a big change in its usage. And so they can get these big step changes like that. I should point out that, yes, Bitcoin mining is a hugely energy-intensive thing in itself. There was a UN report that was put out last year that estimated it used about something like 132 terawatt-hours, which is comparable to the energy use of Ukraine. And the main Bitcoin miner in the world is the United States. I think China stopped their Bitcoin mining. So US is one of the biggest. And I think Bitcoin mining uses something like 2% of America's energy consumption. So it is quite a big thing locally there. But yeah, but the point is that you can sometimes get these big step changes that increase the efficiency. However, the other thing to bear in mind is something that kind of, I didn't know there was a name for, but it is something we probably all notice, which is something called Jevons paradox or Jevons paradox, which is an economic principle discovered in 1865. So this is named after an economist, William Stanley Jevons, and he observed that coal technology improvements and efficiencies did not cut the use of coal. It increased the use of coal because it made it cheaper.
Well, that's an economic principle that applies to lots of things, really, isn't it? Is if you want people to use something less, then making it cheaper is not going to help do that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of us, in particular governments, will focus on like efficiencies and things and hope for, say, fuel efficiencies and energy efficiencies will reduce resource consumption. And this is going to be one of the things that saves us if we look at, you know, some of the hopes for the future. But yeah, this Jevons paradox and the way things are generally played out is when you make things more efficient, you make them cheaper, and then people use them more, and you get this kind of rebound effect. And so, yes, AI is certainly getting more efficient as time goes on. We've seen that. I think the Google's AI was a lot cheaper to train than the ChatGPT. However, yeah, the cheaper it becomes, the more it will be used. And you've got impending technologies like self-driving cars on the horizon, which are going to require even greater AI use. It's not going to slow down anytime soon. So, yeah, I don't know. There's no set answer to this. I guess we can hope for there will be some big changes that might make these things more efficient. But as we embrace AI more and more, we are going to have more and more energy consumption, which is something that the world is going to have to deal with and something that you should bear in mind whenever you're using these technologies, I think.
I mean, it just comes down to the fact that we need to... The energy question is the biggest question that faces humans at the moment for all tech, really.
Yeah.
We've got to get to some sort of energy supply that is not concurrently destroying the planet, which is kind of the problem we have.
And perhaps a good example, yeah, it is probably on that supply side where the answers are going to lie rather than trying to reduce energy consumption, because that just seems to create more problems down the track.
I think we're lost.
We're not lost.
Not even any short-range radio signals yet?
Except for a single, very powerful radio emission.
Of course, a transmitter of that sort isn't exactly standard equipment.
The science and technology must be absolutely mind-boggling.
Of course, that's mostly on the theoretical side.
What so far?
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
So regular listeners might have heard me talking on Lost in Science about my research, which seems like it was a whole other lifetime ago, where I was looking at the mycorrhizal fungi of Australian plants in the Ericaceae family. And just to show how fickle science can be, they had their own family when I started my research. They were the Apocridaceae family. But someone else's research put them in their place. Now, I shouldn't really say science is fickle. It's a work in progress. It's not a fixed body of knowledge. And when new evidence comes along that things are not as we thought, science shifts to the best explanation.
And look, let's be honest. Taxonomy is just, it's made up anyway to a large extent. But my question was going to be, who was Ericaceae?
It's the plant family is called Ericaceae after the ericas, which are the heath plants.
Okay.
Yeah. Apocris is the floral emblem of Victoria, and it gave the name to the Apocridaceae family, but they're so closely related that basically, you know, and as you say, it's sort of made up, but they looked at genetic information and went, yeah, these are really closely related plants. We'll put them all together as one big happy family. But so mycorrhizas are not a new thing. They've been around probably since plants first appeared on the land and certainly allowed plants to establish in places they otherwise wouldn't have reached. Mycorrhizas, for anyone who's forgotten, are mutualistic relationships between plants and fungi. And they're a kind of symbiosis where both partners obtain some benefit from the connection, but it's not always an equal benefit. So it doesn't really matter. It's still a symbiotic mutualism.
So is this like what you got, say, a tree with roots in the ground?
Mm.
And so is there like fungus essentially is living on the roots that is processing nutrients in the soil and then the tree is consuming those nutrients? Is it something like that?
Basically, that's it. So the fungi are capable of breaking down organic matter into simpler molecules, and they're basically, especially they're making complex organic molecules into water-soluble nutrients, which then the plant roots can absorb. So plants can't do that, but fungi do that all the time. That's how they get their nutrients. So the plants get nutrients they wouldn't otherwise have access to. Plants make sugar in their leaves, the carbohydrates that are the energy source of most living things on Earth. The fungi benefit from this by growing close to the plant roots, and sometimes even inside the plant roots in some mycorrhizas. So the plants get nutrients they wouldn't otherwise have access to. The fungi get sugar they're not able to make themselves. And it all seems like a very straightforward tit-for-tat arrangement. But of course, being biology and ecology, it isn't that simple. There's a lot more going on than this simple two-way street. And this story takes us into the tangled web of interaction beneath the forest floor and also stretching back into the lab of the people who study this stuff. So the direct relationships between individual plants and individual fungi was pretty well established. The first when this was first discovered, people went, "Oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense," and it's a pretty simple thing to understand, I suppose. But some researchers had noticed that the same fungal species were forming mycorrhizas with different plant species, and they thought, "Well, what's going on there?" Is that you'd think it would be this specialized relationship. So this led to experiments to see where the connections between multiple plants of different species could move things around via these fungal connections, these networks under the ground. And some work showed from 1984 showed that it was possible for sugars made in the leaves of one plant could appear in the tissues of another plant. They used radioactively labeled carbon that they could sort of introduce it to one plant and it appeared in the other plant. And it was the only connection between them was this fungal connection.
Right, so these are completely different species that are essentially swapping chemicals via the fungal networks.
Yep, that is right. But this was in the lab, and this is a big thing. It's like growing, you know, cells in a petri dish. It's not really an indication of a working system. It's just an experiment. So there was a surge in interest in the study of mycorrhizas, and people working on forests, particularly in Canada and the Northern Hemisphere. They showed that it was possible for fungi to form mycorrhizal relationships with multiple species in the field. So they actually could test this in living forests. And that was shown in 1997. So then the idea took off, and the term wood wide web, which I alluded to in the intro, was actually come up with by the news team at Nature, who is not the same people who published the journal, and they made that very clear when I was reading about this. They coined that term, and some of the authors of those papers started writing books which were just for sale to the general public. And this is kind of where the idea sort of started to stray away from the science. So they started writing books about the possibility of interconnected mycelial networks connecting entire forests. And then they sort of extrapolated that not only nutrients, but chemical signals could be passing through the networks, and that some trees and plants could favor individuals of their own species by preferential delivery of chemicals and hormones and all sorts of things. And this is, as I say, this is where the popularizing of the idea kind of runs into trouble. You don't have the checks and balances of peer review. You don't have the statistical analysis that you apply to journal articles. It's a popular science book, and you might have an editor and you might have advisors, but there's not that same level of rigor. And you get the authors using analogies and metaphors, and you kind of lose the science in the storytelling. And that's how you attract the public attention, is by telling a good story. But the science can kind of get lost among the speculation. So one of the big problems with demonstrating that plants can preferentially favor individual seedlings or work against other plants in the forest is that it's almost impossible to remove all the confounding factors. If you were trying to show that this is what's happening, it's virtually impossible to do it in the field, and it's very difficult to do it in a laboratory setting. One experiment that was set up to test the idea that individual plants were being favored actually ended up showing that more often than not, seedlings descended from a parent fared more poorly in competition with the parent plant. But even then, if you looked at all the stats, the results were not statistically significant. So there was a slight disadvantage from being descended from a tree that you're growing near as a little tree seedling. But even that wasn't actually a statistically significant figure. It was just, oh, they did a little bit worse than the other ones. So, that, you know, testing these things and getting actual data that proves or demonstrates the point is very hard.
I mean, yeah, look, we like to think of trees as these kind of, I don't know, noble spirit creatures that are all about cooperation and, yeah, loving nature and this sort of stuff. But, I mean, even the very existence of a tree itself, like a thing that has to be taller than everything around it so it can get all the light, they're competitive. They're looking out for themselves.
Well, and you know, in an even less anthropomorphizing way, they're not looking out for anything. They're just doing what they do.
Yeah, true, true.
What they do is dominate other plants. They're really good at it. The other thing is there's numerous other hypotheses around the multiple partnerships between fungi and plants. So the idea that there's these specified roots or there's some advantage, it's a big field and there's lots of work. And you kind of find, like in every other aspect of science, there's trends, there's fashions of what people do their research on. One of the theories or one of the hypotheses that I came across when I was doing my research is that, you know, the idea that there's cooperation between species of plants isn't really shown by anything. But the other idea, or the one that was sort of on the decline when this idea appeared, was that in the absence of disturbances, mycorrhizal relationships actually alter the species makeup of forests over time. So you get a fungus that benefits more from one species of plant, but the fungus directly benefits a different species. So it's giving more benefit to another species, and the original species kind of dies away over time and you get replaced by this other species. So it's a form of successional change in the forests. Which is a completely workable theory, and they are all still competing with each other as individuals and as species as well. So it's just that it sort of went out of fashion, so no one's really followed up on that research, but it's a pretty solid hypothesis anyway. Another thing to consider about this work too is that a lot of it's been done in the Northern Hemisphere, in Northern Hemisphere ecosystems, and might not really be universally applicable beyond the forests of British Columbia where a lot of the work happened. If you take it somewhere else, it might not work that way. It might be a completely different system. In 2003, I went to British Columbia to look for mycorrhizal fungi in a plant called Salal, which is related to an Australian native species in the Ericaceae called Gaultheria oppressa. I dug up plants. I found a few dozen different fungi growing in the roots of Canadian plant. And then I dug up plants in Australia of the related species and found a whole different set of fungi growing in the Australian plants. None of them were the same fungi at all. They weren't even closely related. But if I put them in the lab, I got mycorrhizas to form in the Canadian plants with the Australian fungi. I got mycorrhizas to form in the Australian plants with the Canadian fungi. They all worked together, but they're just not there. So whether they interact in that way, there's no way of really knowing. So I think this sort of idea, and there has been, as I said earlier, there's been reviews into the research to figure out if what has been written about in some of the more popular books and magazine articles about this scientific understanding is actually supported. And the reviews show, no, it's not really supported that there's any sort of global forest-wide communication network that links all the plants in the forest to one plant or anything like that. It just doesn't really stand up. What it is clear is that there's a lot more to understand about mycorrhizal fungi and about forest ecology and how it varies in different places based on climatic differences and you know, other environmental factors. The idea of species actually cooperating rather than interacting for their own benefit will take a lot more evidence than anyone's really been able to present so far. So it's a nice idea, but we don't really have the science to back that up.
Yeah, basically not seeing the trees for the forest. Is that what's going on there?
Yeah, that's about right. We'll be right back. And that is all we have time for this week on Lost in Science. Thank you for joining us in Getting Lost. If you have any questions or suggestions for the team, get in touch with us by email. We are lostinsci@gmail.com. You can send cheap tweets to us at lostinscience1 on Twitter, or you can find us on the ubiquitous Facebook. Lost in Science is recorded at the studios of 3CR in Melbourne on the land of the Kulin Nation and is broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find a podcast version of the show on 3cr.org.au, or you can tune in the way you did this week when we return in our usual time slot to get
Lost in Science!
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.